Welcome to the XR Motion Podcast, where we go over everything in the future digital art space and field. Today, we have an amazing guest with us. His name is Tom Coben, and just check out his work real quick. Look at this. If you're listening to just audio, go look him up at Tom Coben. That's T-O-M-C-O-B-E-N. Or just, you know, go look him up now. Anyway, so today we've got a great episode. I hope y'all are excited. I mean, there's just so much knowledge bombs. I mean, I've seen this guy's work for years. I hope you guys are excited for this episode because it's a good one. So hold on to your seats because they're about to go flying because you're going to be so excited that your excitement lifts because excitement is lighter than air. Whoo! All right. Anyway, here's the episode.
This is the XR Motion Podcast with your hosts, Michael Steinberg and Andrew Hogue.
You know, starting out with maybe some of your more obscure programs, I feel like a lot of people can relate to that. I was like a Windows Movie Maker guy when I started, you know, many, many years ago. But at a certain point, you transitioned to Cinema 4D. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what prompted the transition, how you got to learning, and sort of how you built your foundation that you're working in today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I went to Lawrence University in Wisconsin. I was an environmental studies major there. And we didn't, at the time, Lawrence didn't really have much of a film specific department. It had a bit of film studies, but not really production kind of side. It was sort of being built up at that time. So by the time I was a junior, senior, we had a bit of those classes kind of coming out. So I had started taking some of these film studies and sort of these, like, had these classes called like digital processes, which was kind of just general kind of digital art, including photography and some general other stuff, but they weren't super production based. They're still kind of more theoretical and kind of, you know, I was kind of looking to have some kind of, you know, get my hands dirty and like learn some actual software and get like really into it. So I sort of took that upon myself then and started using Cinema 4D kind of personally and just kind of to learn it. And I followed a bunch of great tutorials that were out, you know, 10 years ago or longer. Anyway, so I started using that. I had an incredible sculpture professor that I had taken an intro class with one, like my junior year, and then senior year, I wanted to take sculpture too, but he was super chill because I asked him, instead of just doing the normal sculpture process, could I basically use that time as an opportunity to like teach myself Cinema 4D and do my sculptures in 3D, which I would then like camera track into spots on campus. And he was totally down and said that'd be cool. So that was really cool of him. And I was always, you know, pretty grateful for that opportunity, but it was kind of more of an independent study kind of that I kind of focused the learning of Cinema 4D and other animation kind of stuff. And
yeah, no, that's amazing that you were, you know, in a program that gave you the leniency to sort of pursue that yourself. You mentioned, you know, camera tracking, which kind of gets into the world of VFX, which sort of got me thinking, you know, we learned how you kind of, you started experimenting with, but what are your influences? What, you know, everyone has their sort of, I saw this movie and I saw this shot, or, you know, you kind of watch breakdowns and you're like, oh man, that's definitely something I would love to do as a career. What, you know, where's the convergence of all these things for you in terms of why you pursued this? What draws you to VFX, compositing, animation, 3D? I mean, you kind of do have the breadth of it, but what is sort of the pull for you?
I mean, there's a huge amount of influence, as I say, but if I had to pick one as like my main one, it's watching the Lord of the Rings behind the scenes documentaries when I was a 13-year-old boy. I think like I watched, you know, all of the behind the scenes post-production diaries or whatever, and there was like,
which there were hours and hours and hours of, which thank God they did it, because I agree with you 100%. It's an amazing, it's like OG before BTS went viral on Instagram or Twitter or anything. That is the original, like, get the DVD bonus features and you're gonna really enjoy just like digging through how they managed to make Helm's Deep and massive crowd simulations. It was wild.
It was incredible. Yeah. Watching like, when they developed like the massive thing and all that stuff was great. All that stuff. I mean, when I first started watching it, I was definitely kind of more thinking of it as like, ooh, I want to make movies. But also like watching all like the VFX behind the scenes stuff was just incredible.
For sure. And I mean, at that time too, the crazy thing to, you know, one, I would say, I think Lord of the Rings holds up in terms of a trilogy. I watch it pretty much every year with my fiance. We're like, it's a once a year thing for us just because I'm so in love with the books and all of it. But the other thing is, it's, to me, it's always a lesson of going back. I remember the moment that you kind of have this realization that if you can manage things in production that will make post-production look better, it's worth, you know, lighting a scene knowing that you're going to put a CG light source in, you know, that sells realism. And so much of what Peter Jackson did with that trilogy, I feel like, was a perfect blend of practical and computer generated effects.
Oh yeah.
Just made it all, you know, they, as much of the budget went to computer generated stuff, I feel like an equal amount went to hair and makeup and like developing prosthetics for orcs and like doing the, you know, the full VFX makeup treatment for a lot of stuff. I mean, it's so good.
Totally. I feel like it was made at exactly the right time too, for like how well it holds up, just because it was made at like kind of the peak of like practical effects at that time, you know, like it was, you know, where it would be. I mean, all of the prosthetics, I actually did have a Lord of the Rings watch party where I watched all three movies last weekend. So
nice. So it's like top of mind. You're like, I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been thinking about it a lot and just like watching, like, you know, just seeing all the incredible prosthetics and, all that stuff.
And lest we forget, I mean, that was Andy Serkis's, that, you know, his performance of Gollum, that is like maybe the first motion capture performance that we can point to where that level of expression that was sort of generally missing from that kind of process was totally there. You know, I mean, the voice, the movement, for all of it to work in tandem, it's incredible to watch. So I hear you on that being a main source of inspiration. It's really hard to watch those and not be like, how would I make Gollum if I were to do it, you know, today?
Right. Yeah, no, totally.
Which, and to that end, one of the other things we were very curious to talk to you about, and I can see if you're as big of a Lord of the Rings fan as you are, there's so much of a dark aesthetic and sort of an unsettling, uncanny, like there's something about those movies at certain points where I don't know, for me at least, I feel that sort of like, God, this is such good world building. And like, I would have never put all these ideas into one place. And I feel like so much of your work is sort of a, you know, I think you've described it yourself as like reimagining these sort of like early idea, you know, Thomas the Tank Engine, going to a bowling alley, but kind of injecting your own aesthetic to them it's a new way to look at it. What, you know, with the work you're making right now, what brought you to this place of being able to melt all these worlds together and kind of find your own voice?
I mean, I think at the beginning, a lot of it just, you know, it started certainly just to, like, wanting to make something that looks real. And then, you know, there was a lot of obviously steps that come before that, just trying to figure out, like working with the software and trying to get, you know, things to look accurate and stuff. But then realizing that once you get to that place, you can actually push it a lot farther from just like replicating reality and make something like way cooler. So, I mean, and like on the dark side, I mean, I think that, I mean, I definitely do enjoy, you know, that kind of turning, I don't know, maybe lighthearted things on their head a little bit and making them a little creepy. I just find that pretty fun. And I mean, I when I first started doing the Thomas stuff, you know, that was during, I did like 100 days, like every days. And so that was part of that. And I was just like, you know, racking my brain, like, you know, to start thinking of like weird shit I can do.
So I have to ask too. Yeah. So I discovered your work, when I would like to say it was one of the first Thomas renders, went pretty big on Reddit, and I happened to stumble up, you know, across it. Was that before or after? Because there's another Reddit subreddit that kind of comes across my radar all the time, which is the like I'm sorry John.
Where
it's, you know, and so was that pre or post? Because I feel like I discovered both at the same time, and I'm not sure if you know, which informed the other kind of thing.
I'm sorry, John definitely came first, cause I've definitely seen that before I had done the Thomas stuff. And that was definitely a source of inspiration. I actually had forgotten about that, but that's definitely a source of inspiration.
You've expanded it beyond the universe of one, you know, of one sort of subject matter. Whereas I'm sorry, John is just all Garfield all the time.
Right.
Which I love. Yeah.
It's so funny. I don't know. It's great.
And was your Thomas series, maybe was that where, and I have to ask just because I found you sort of through that. Was there traction before? Did you feel like you were, you know, was it one of those things where you felt like you sort of struck gold in terms of concept and execution and being able to reach a broader audience?
It did. It definitely helped me reach a much broader audience. I had had a few other videos that had gone kind of viral before that. Specifically the bowling robot.
Yeah. I remember that one. I remember sharing that around.
Which was a lot of fun. That was also part of the 100 days kind of thing that I was doing. But that one went crazy. It got like, I think it was like 20 million views on like Twitter or something, and then Will Smith posted it, so it was just like, yeah, okay, it's everywhere.
Dude, what the, so the other, and I guess the other, I mean, as someone who found your work maybe later than the bowling piece, which now I feel like, oh my god, I'm like, I'm not hip at all, I should have seen that one. But that's what's crazy is that those two pieces, I mean, I can, you know, now knowing your broader body of work and like seeing, I don't know if you have a name for the series, but I call, you know, the alleyways, the like hallways that are, you know, that now that I'm familiar with the work, it does all make sense in a body of work. But at the time I would have, you know, I would have never associated like, even just in terms of its sort of hard ops modeling machinery, you know, the bowling piece versus this like organic, terrifying, you know, crawler of Thomas the Tank Engine. Would you say that being able to hit both of those styles is a byproduct of doing, you know, 100 days of art every day? Or is it just that like you are interested in both those mediums?
Well, I guess both. I mean, I do like doing lots of different things. Like, I don't really want to just be doing Thomas videos from now on. You know, like, they're fun to do, but they take a lot of time. And also, it's just like, I don't know. I really like doing the kind of more psychedelic stuff lately. And you know, it's the hallway thing. I call it the Vertigo series, for the record.
Okay. Oh, right. And I probably should know that because I've.
Oh no, it's fine.
You describe it as such, but yes, the Vertigo series, of course.
Yeah. So those are super fun. I do want to make more of those for sure.
I love those, for the record. I think they're so.
I love how it has this realism to it while it's so abstract and out there, you know, and it doesn't feel like too cartoony. It's just great.
It's the kind of stuff that's gonna like pop up in my REM cycle, you know, like it's the perfect amalgamation of, you know, and actually you just said recently earlier photorealism is a great place to start, and this is kind of an Andrew Price tip that I'm a Blender guy, and I so he was someone I learned a lot from early on. you know, photorealism was always something good to achieve for, because if you can achieve photorealism, then you can achieve what's beyond photorealism, which is this, you know, taking it and like, turning it on its head. Even it doesn't even need to be a subject matter. It can just be the physical world that you interact with every day. And so, yeah, the Vertigo series, I feel like, is such an excellent example of that, which I guess kind of also leads me to, when I saw your Vertigo series, I was like, this kind of looks like a lot of stuff that's coming out in Unreal. You know, there's, you know, Unreal's had some huge leaps and bounds in terms of photorealism and stuff. And I think, I don't know if I'm wrong in this, but is that still Cinema 4D, all the Vertigo stuff?
Yep. Yeah, it's all Cinema 4D. It's actually, I basically just use kind of proxy geometries to kind of get the actual motion and then apply that to a much
interesting.
Because that's my thing is like when you look at the brick texture on any of, you know, to have UV maps with what looks to be like displacement sort of alternating rows, like you're not doing that with a low poly scene.
So it's just, and that stuff, actually all that stuff is done mostly in After Effects. Well, not in After Effects, but I make the textures in After Effects, where I would get like a high res PBR texture, and then I would do a series of kind of distortions on each map the same way. So I do it on a series of adjustment layers, which I then apply to both, you know, the color, displacement, normal, and everything. And so then you bring it in as an image sequence, and then you can get the actual movement.
That is nuts. I love that. Golden nugget. That's the golden nugget.
That's the gold tip for the day.
That's a,
If you've listened to any of these episodes, the only thing I like to do on more than anything, more than learning about an artist's story and what they're excited about, is shitting on Adobe. Like, it's too easy. But like when you hear an instance of that, like that is an amazing use case for After Effects. Absolutely.
Yeah. Love thanks, sir. I think I'm getting my camera's being weird. I'm gonna switch to my other camera.
Yeah, no worries.
Man, yeah, that is great though. That is
I would have
fun.
Never guessed. I thought for sure it was like I don't use Cinema, but I would assume there's some way to animate mappings of textures in Cinema. So I thought it was that, but damn, that's crazy.
Yeah, that looks so good. Man, I really love just how fun. I mean, it's just like it has like almost like a trance to it. Like I just keep staring at it and I just see myself just like, oh, I'm like, am I like leaning into the video? It's so good.
The reason I brought up Unreal is because I do see your work sometimes and I think this would be, if I could put, I'm not big into VR right now, I don't own a headset. I mean, I've used VR and I think it's amazing. I haven't made the jump of like, let me make this something I'm, you know, regularly interacting with. But I feel like when I see your stuff, I'm like, I would love to put a headset on and just be in this like, you could probably only do it for so long because you might get like motion sick.
Probably.
But there's something about, you have so much detail in your textures. You have so much, I mean, you've nailed the photorealism thing so well that it's like, I would love to experience this in sort of real time, you know, being able to look around.
Yeah. I would love to try to like, I think I'd have to render some pretty huge, pieces. Yeah, but I'm trying to figure out how to switch my camera.
You might
back
have
on.
To refresh. There we go. It's funny enough. I just started using videos in Cinema 4D. I don't know why. I've never thought about using them as textures. You know, and I think it's N Joyce. She's like a art director around New York. She's But I remember she did some cool stuff with like liquids, like liquid materials using like, you know, I think it was like a thing a few years ago where everybody was doing like using microscopes and doing crazy paint textures where like with different types of liquids and getting some really cool. She did a phenomenal one, but recently I'm doing Nick's, I think it's Endless Engine competition.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Thing. Yeah, I'm doing mine right now. I don't know if I'll hit the deadline. I'm excited about it, but you know, anytime you have a really strong deadline, you really start thinking very creatively on how you can pull off some effects you want. And I'm just like, man, okay, I don't think I'm gonna have time to like mess around with a bunch of particles right now. So I'm just using alpha layers, and
is actually, I don't know why I've never done it before, but it's given me some pretty cool effects and it's rendering extremely fast, like a little too shocking. You know?
I think there's often like, I don't know, not a misconception, but I think a lot of people want to do everything in one program.
Yeah.
A lot of time. And so like, which ends up hurting you, or it can. Like, you, if you have the time, it can be amazing. So like, if you want to, you know, if you need to, if you want to get like perfect motion blur or something in render, like, okay, great. If you have the time to do that, then awesome. But like most of the time, especially if you're just like uploading to Instagram or like whatever, it doesn't matter. Like, you can do that in post.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild.
I just took Gleb Alexandrov's cinematic lighting course for Blender. And I think it's one of those courses where even if you don't use Blender, he does an excellent job of illustrating use cases where, okay, perfect example. You want to cut back on rendering time and you want to cut back on compositing time. Make some lens flares that are alpha layered and bring them in as image planes and put them in your scene where you want them. I mean, it doesn't always work. If you're looking for true photorealism for like a 3-minute shot, that's probably not the technique. But exactly to your point, Tom, if you're putting together something that you want to be real worthy, that's a 5-second shot that might live on social, like, and it's a hard lesson to learn, because honestly, I think for me, it takes going through the process of trying to do it in the perfect way. And then being like, oh my God, I wasted 7 hours of compositing on something that probably could have been cheated, for lack of a better word, with a different technique.
Totally. I mean, I still do it all the time where it's like, oh, I can just let this go for like a day.
But yeah, like if you're having a day where you're like, I want to go out and grab a coffee and just like hang out a little bit. Yeah, I can get away with just my computer's rendering, so I can't be working on anything else. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, man, there's like so many questions I want to ask. I guess I'll ask this one. When it comes to making one of your 3D artworks / renders, how do you know it's done? Do you have anything that is like on the checklist? Is it a feeling?
Yeah, that's a tough. I mean, that's a really tough one. I mean, especially for like the Vertigo series that I was doing, like those, I just kept on adding detail and I was like working on them for like weeks. You know, it's just like at the end, it is kind of just a feeling, and it often is a feeling of just like, I'm really sick of this project. and then at that point I'll be done. but you know, there's a level of polish that I want it to have, obviously. And so it's just trying to approach that, I guess. But it's, you know, it often comes down to like, you know, I've been working on this for weeks and I just need to stop.
No, I feel that. Well, so my next question is it's funny, cause with your Thomas the Nightmare engine, there, you kind of had like, I don't know, I think it was your most popular one. It's a pretty long piece, like, right? It's about 2 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And how do you go into kind of developing that story out? Is it something where you knew you had a guy running in? Is it something where you kind of maybe just put a few frames together and said, that's the sequence of thought? How did you block that out?
So the story with that, I think this is the Engine of Chaos one. So that one, I kind of just did it on the fly, like shot by shot. It's not the way you should probably do it, but I was just like, I figured out the first shot and I was like, okay, what now? And then I just kind of went like, you know, I would block the shots out. And eventually I had like a kind of a story, but it was not pre-planned that well. Like, it was kind of just dicking around until I like had something that worked. I was like, you know, by the time he finally caught him, I was like, could I just like add a few more shots in between, or like what could happen after? He's like, nah, this is done. definitely not the way that I would probably approach it if I was actually doing it for a client. But because it was just my own thing, I was just like, I want to just go completely linearly and not really plan it out and just see what happens.
Now that makes sense.
How many projects have you had where you are approaching it with basically blank slate, no reference for yourself, you know, because I think there's value in doing like a storyboarded sequence sometimes, but I also think there's definitely value in being like the urgency of the moment. You end up in a point in the timeline and you're like, I need to figure out how to fill the space. Is that something that you challenge yourself with often as a creator, or is that something that, you know, recently you've been doing more of? Or
I mean, when I'm working with clients, I do typically prefer them to have kind of an amount of direction, obviously. Like, I don't really like going into a project with like full creative control, because that's just basically like nothing. Yeah. But I mean, occasionally that's nice. Like, you want to have some amount, but like, I think working within a box helps you creatively, honestly. Like, if you have complete freedom to do, like, just make me a commercial. It's like, no, I'm not, like, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, and to that end, it's like, if a client doesn't know what, you know, the questions I always ask are like, what are you trying to accomplish with this at the very least? Because, you know, if you go into a project and it's like, make me a commercial, it's like, well, make me a commercial about what? You know, what story mm-hmm. are you trying to tell? Right. Like, what product are you trying to sell? If you don't give me that up front, you're pretty much asking to find yourself at the back end of a project and they're like, we're not happy with this.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, well, no, exactly.
It's also like, there's can be no revisions. You know, if you honestly, when I always feel that way, if you're going to give me complete creative control over everything, I do not want revisions. This
right,
isn't
right. Yeah, okay,
this
great.
Isn't make this a starting it. Point for me to get ideas from. This is right. I'll make you a piece and that's what it is and I'll put effort into it. But right. You know,
it's you're getting what you're getting.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because I hate you, that. It's like, make.
Would you say, Tom, that like your creative work deviates from the process you have for your client work in order to sort of find yourself in the spaces you've been working in terms of your personal work?
In a sense, I mean, you know, a lot of the commercial work, especially, I mean, for the last few years anyway, like it hasn't been as like weird as what I'm mostly making.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I I actually have gotten some clients that want the weird, like they, you know, I've been approached from a few places that have seen the Thomas stuff and they want like kind of a horror vibe. And I've done a few horror pieces like, you know, to that end. But, you know, I will, when I'm on like a actual job, I will storyboard things and I'll make mood boards and I'll do the whole thing. But, I feel like when I'm working, you know, for myself, usually I will say sometimes like for the Vertigo series, like I'll pull together a lot of reference and do like stuff. If I'm trying to make a specific like alleyway or bathroom, I'll like find a ton of reference and like do all that stuff. But a lot of the time it's a kind of more of an organic kind of, process, because I don't have a timeline when I'm working for myself.
Right. Which gives you the flexibility to say, I don't need to meet, you know, I don't need to have this stuff prepped for this next client meeting. I don't, you know, there's,
I mean, if I don't have to share what I'm thinking to anybody else, I can just do what I want.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I actually find that to be one of the hardest parts about client work for me specifically, is like a lot of clients will want weekly check-ins or, you know,
yeah.
And sometimes it's like, look, I didn't really get what I needed from the last meeting because you were still pulling some stuff together. Like, I'm not going to have something I feel confident showing every week. Right. Sometimes I might just even be exploring, you know, in between meetings or something. So, yeah, I totally get the concept of, in your personal work, it is nice to just be, you know, free yourself from some of those constraints. I feel like constraining yourself in other ways, I feel like a theme here has been, you know, a box is not necessarily an awful thing to work in. And in some cases it gives you the ability to find new solutions and, you know.
I think it helps creativity. I mean, not, you know, obviously not too tight a box, but you want a framework, you know, you want something to work off of, because otherwise,
like to the end of your Vertigo series, it's sort of like, if you went into it saying, I want to make everything in Cinema 4D, you might not have perfected the workflow of, oh, well, I actually don't need to waste my, you know, maybe it's more efficient to go into After Effects and animate some textures and then apply them, you know?
Yeah.
That's something where if you had given yourself a strict constraint of being like, I want to work in one program and one program only, it would have been a shortcoming probably.
For sure.
So I do want to, I'm super curious. I mean, like, you're making this like high, unsettling, abstract content that's very cool. And then you have, you know, obviously freelance work, right? And we were just kind of talking about how much of your freelance work is actually kind of more focused on your artistic style being delivered in that work versus it being like, okay, I'm doing a JCPenney commercial and they just want some 3D pants, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, so like, you know, this year I did like an Amex commercial, and it's mostly just visual effects and like some, a lot of cleanup and like mocha kind of painting stuff and whatever. But no, I do. I mean, I have had a number of like great clients. I did it was for Coachella this past year.
Ooh.
There was a Black Parade. Wow. Like My Chemical Romance kind of thing. And
really?
My Chemical Romance and Madonna.
Can you tell? No, I'm, I'm a fan.
Yeah. Well, it was just a small part of this kind of concert visual, basically, that was happening in the background. And it was for My Black Parade. And they basically wanted the Vertigo effect on, like, the super long, infinite, like, church corridor that the camera was flying down. So, like, that was very literally, like, exactly what I was doing. You know, like, so, like, that,
yeah, yeah,
that,
just do it with this set piece.
Right, they're just like, do this like this.
I have to ask, was it, like, actually for the band?
No, it was the song, it was, like, a remix, so it was,
okay, love it, yeah, love yeah. it. I would be like, we're talking after the show, you're gonna yeah. be the name, the number, no, I'm just kidding.
Unfortunately. Yeah, it was emo night. So,
oh, snap. Okay. Yeah. Wow. My friend is like a creative director over there. So that is awesome. Yeah. Sweet. Yeah. Wow.
Cool. So yeah, that was a super fun project and very targeted to, you know, my aesthetic, I guess.
But you're not always working in such sort of like, we saw your work, we want you to do exactly
yeah.
that.
No, I have a number of clients. I mean, for many years now that I continue doing work for. In fact, so my first like 3D job was when I worked at this video production company, and I did accident reconstruction for
attorneys. Ooh, that's yeah. fun. Simulation yeah. to the max, right?
Holy yeah, shit,
I
mean, dude.
I would work with, you know, a forensics guy, and they would give me like data. And I actually this year I've started doing that again because from the same client they just you know, I hadn't heard from them in a while, and then now we're kind of, you know, I'd done 3 or 4 of them this year, so that's obviously quite different than what I'm doing, but it's, you know, it would do like scene photos and I'd use those to kind of build a 3D scene and then do a car crash or other incident that happened, usually a car crash.
I want to ask. As you being somebody that's hyper creative, how do you balance your work life versus personal work and free time?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think like I'm lucky in the sense that, you know, I sort of made my hobby my job. And it's good and bad because now, like, when I'm not working on personal projects, it's like I sometimes just don't really want to. Or when I'm not working on client projects, I don't necessarily want to make more personal projects because I get kind of burnt out. So that is kind of a balancing act sometimes. But, you know, these last couple of weeks, I now kind of finished up. I went on vacation and then I came back and I finally had some like free time. And so I've been working on a couple like little things kind of personally. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a challenge, or it can be, you know, as a freelancer. So I've been freelance now for, about 8 years. And like, you know, it comes in waves, right? So like I've been fortunate in the last few years to have kept pretty busy for the most part, but you know, occasionally I'll just have like a month or two with nothing. It's like, all right. So like those are the times that ideally, like I want to say that I focus on personal work, and I often do, but then I also play a lot of video games and like whatever. But I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, it's like I said, it's a balancing act for sure.
Now I want to ask, and you don't have to get into price point specifics, but I'm just very curious. I know you said you've made, you know, you kind of have your hobby as your job. Monetization through social media, do you find that to be something that's like extremely helpful, or is that kind of something that's not really doing too much?
It can be, for sure. I mean, yeah, so I have a YouTube channel now, and, you know, so and that's where, like, I've been getting a ton of views for the Thomas-specific stuff. So, like, when I make a new Thomas video, that's where it blows up. Like, other places, it might get a little bit of play, but, like, YouTube is where it's at for that specifically. And so, like, I've built kind of an audience around that. And every time I try to post something else, they'll be like, make Thomas videos. So it's like, whatever. I mean, I don't really, I still post other things, but it's just kind of funny. Because every time I post, like, one of the psychedelic things, they're like, this is cool, but, like, we want Thomas videos.
Now, can you do this, but with Thomas?
Yeah, where's Thomas? So you know, I've been monetizing that, and that's gone pretty well. I mean, it's fine. You know, it's not like a crazy amount of money, but it's definitely a nice kind of source of supplemental kind of income. And, you know, it's, it is certainly kind of pushing me to make more Thomas videos specifically because of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoy them too, but if I like, I probably wouldn't have made so many if, you know, they weren't making me a little bit of money on YouTube.
No, for sure. Definitely. I mean, because it is interesting because especially with YouTube, you know, and it's funny, my wife, she's a high school art teacher, and, you know, you're just seeing kids nowadays. She's like, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? And so many kids say, oh, I want to be a YouTuber. Like, mm-hmm. Whoa, what? I mean, it has a pretty good monetization thing, and you are seeing people making millions now on YouTube if you're really into it. So it's cool to, you know, be seeing, you know, people getting super successful just off of 3D animations on the platform, and kind of being like, yeah, you don't have to be just a vlogger or, it's really cool. And just one last question with socials, like a lot of your form seems to be 16:9. How do you see your work? Do you remodify your work at all for the 9:16, like TikTok, you know, and all those?
I won't like re-render it or anything usually, but I will often at least consider it as like when I'm making it. So like when I did like the Thomas stuff, I was like, I should probably make sure that most of the action happens, you know, within something around here, you know, like it would be kind of more vertical than horizontal, I guess. And not to say that there isn't that. And what I'll usually do is if I'm going to put it on TikTok or Instagram, I'll still put some like letter boxes on the top and bottom to kind of give me a little more space. Sure, and then smart. I'll also kind of move it. I'll animate it in post in After Effects if I
just need left to. And right. Yeah.
Just left and right. So if like,
right. It's wow. It's actually, I feel like that is kind of one smart. Of those hacks that does not always get discussed.
Yeah.
Because I'm often taking 16:9 to 1:1. It used to be 4:5. Yeah. Thank God that's gone. It's basically it's 9:16, 16:9, and 1:1.
Yeah.
But the 9:16 stuff, it sucks. It fucking sucks. Like it is terrible. I hate, especially if you're given like the safety areas for TikTok. There's no. I mean, you have a 3:4 frame within a 9:16 frame that you can actually do anything in. Yeah. But I think hearken to your point, like if you can keep the majority of your action in the center third of the frame,
mm-hmm.
it could be like, you know, over, I think the default guides in After Effects give you, or the default composition guides are 3:2 or 2:2. So you just have thirds, right?
Yeah.
Keep it in the center third. And if you have some overlap that you really want to focus on, only keyframe the exposition in After Effects, get a mat that you can reference and just move. It doesn't feel that bad. You know, if you know the context of the final animation in 16:9, sometimes you're probably like, I wish I didn't have to do this.
Right.
You know, you might lose a camera move. You might move a focus pull or something, but it's really nice to hear you say that because I feel like that's kind of the cheat that I do with client work a lot where I'm like, yeah, I'll re-render it in 9:16 for you for sure. And by that, I mean, it's just exposition keyframes in After Effects.
Yeah. No, it's interesting though. I mean, it is something to now keep in mind, you know, a lot more because it's just, with TikTok and Instagram being what they are with Reels, it's just like almost platforms you cannot just miss, you know, it's.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I upload all my stuff to YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. So like each time I do render out three versions.
Yeah.
And you know, I'll always like point to the YouTube ones. Like, please watch this on YouTube if you want to see it.
I'll just go ahead and plug really quickly a really good After Effects plugin, super cheap, ascripts.com. It's called 9:16, and it's just a 3-button panel that will load 9:16 guides. It will give you a mock-up of like the Instagram stories template in a 9:16 guide. If you really are so inclined, you could probably set that up yourself as like a pretty simple script to do that stuff. But that was like I don't know what the cost is, but no more than like $5-$10. And I use it all the time, so it's definitely helpful.
Nice. So I know there's like a similar version of that for Cinema 4D that I've been. It's like a plugin from Grayscale Gorilla, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Social Frame, and I use that for sure. Like I had a project that just finished recently that I was working on, and they specifically requested renders that were for TikTok. So those ones, that was super helpful for that.
Nice.
So I don't know if we answered this before. I know I was cutting in and out a little bit, but do you use, I'm going to guess, but Octane, is that kind of your, all right. Yeah. Okay. It's funny. I love Octane so much. I, you know, I can kind of tell, but it's, you know, some people say it's impossible to tell, but I don't know.
Oh no, dude, you can definitely
feel like
tell.
I can tell.
I spend way too much time looking at this stuff to not be able to tell. I don't know. There's just you pick up on little things each engine is stronger at, for sure.
For sure. And yeah, that's just what I learned on, you know, it's when I started going freelance, I built my first PC and specifically to get Octane working, because I was like a Mac guy. And then I was like, okay, well, I need to switch because I need to use Octane. And then you know, since then I've just been on that, and you know, I've just started dipping my toes into Redshift, kind of just on like a working level, just so I can, because I literally like this week I had, or last week I had like a project that was like, we need you to make some changes to this file. It's in Redshift. I was like, I do not know Redshift, but I will look at it. And then I like watch some tutorials and like got the very basics down, but I'm still definitely more of an Octane guy.
I think it's just the worst part is that fundamentally most of these engines are starting to work in a very similar way in terms of achieving path tracing and photorealism and all that stuff. They might calculate light rays slightly differently.
Yeah.
But the frustrating part for me is every time I try to pick up another render engine, it's always just learning. It's like learning a new coding language. It's just like, what is the most efficient way to achieve a really nice translucency? Like, what are the little tiny hacks to make the render a little faster and a little less noisy? Well, and so, you find yourself niched down in an engine and you're like, I don't want to leave it, because so much of what I find myself, like, I've tried to learn Redshift, right? It's not that I can't do this. It's not that I don't understand the fundamentals of what Redshift is doing. It's that I don't know how to get my input translated, in the best way to that engine.
Exactly. And I've developed a workflow. I've made a huge library of materials that I like to use, and it's all for Octane. So it's like, if I were to switch, it would be a pretty big change to my workflow, just because I've built libraries of stuff for Octane that I use all the time.
Huge undertaking, actually. And it wasn't even that big when I looked at it. I was surprised, because I thought for sure if someone had nailed this process, it would blow up. But so I use Blender, I use Cycles X, and you can get Redshift, you can get Octane, you can run it all within Blender's UI. And I had a project that I was like, you know what? From what I've heard of Redshift, I think this would be a good scene to test out in a Redshift render. I do not want to rebuild every material I have in the scene for Redshift. And sure enough, someone made like a Cycles X to Redshift material converter, that calls the proper nodes or whatever. And so I was like, I thought for sure it would be this like number, maybe not a lot of Blender users are using Redshift yet, but those kind of tools where it's like, God, if I could just one click and like have everything translate, to a pretty close approximation, I would absolutely entertain using way more render engines, probably.
Totally.
So I want to ask, what do you personally feel is the craziest creature you've ever made?
I mean, it's got to be Thomas. Like, I don't know. I feel like...
ding, ding, ding.
that's the one that I've put the most time in, certainly. And I've had the most fun kind of developing and revising over the years. I've made some other goofy stuff, but like nothing to that level of complexity that actually has like a facial rig and, a full skeleton and can actually have some, other controls that I kind of built. So like that one, I just put a lot of time into that one. I learned Substance Painter so I could make a better version of it. And like,
I mean, look at those teeth, right? Like those are, is that all real geometry? That's not.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yep.
Yeah, I love how when you do the Thomas the Train Engine, when it goes from like all black and it's just the circles, like the eyes.
I spend a lot of time. I can't remember the scientific name for it, but I looked into the behavior of like cat's eyes basically, and I essentially modeled all of the pieces of an eye so it would actually do that. I ended up having to emphasize it a bit because it wasn't working perfectly, because you would actually have to have like a light going straight at it to reflect back, and then it would just take too long to render. So I ended up putting lights inside the eyes as well. But there's a cornea, there's a lens, there's it's all there.
And that's the other thing I love about photorealism, is that just like I definitely have an obsession with the physical world and sort of why certain there are so many natural phenomena that we experience as human beings that it's hard for me to not be like, what is actually, you know, is it the biology of the eye that makes certain things happen? Is it the biology of the atmosphere? Is it, you know, there's so many, you know, atmospheric effects, lensing effects, all this gravitational lensing, all this crazy stuff about just how we perceive the universe. That's, for me, I think one of the coolest things. And it sounds like you have a sort of similar approach where it's like, when you understand that photorealism, it doesn't mean you always recreate it one-to-one in 3D, but you are kind of given the opportunity to, like, how do I, you know, in your case of like cat's eyes. Yeah. Maybe I can't point lights directly into the eyes so that it bounces back like the, you know, the optic nerve or whatever.
Yeah.
But instead, you know, I can hack it by putting light sources in the eyes. I mean, that's just, I think that's so cool.
When you actually put in the time to kind of learn what's going on and like why those optical things happen, like you get so much for free once you put in like the time up front to like make those structures. I mean, specifically in this case, but it applies to like everything. Like that's why, I mean, I feel like with so many of these, like I like being a freelancer because I get to work on all these different things. I get to learn about, you know, all these different industries, especially of like getting into the nitty gritty of like little things and actually creating those, fully understanding them in a way that you can replicate them in 3D is like a rewarding thing, I think.
Yeah. Honestly, I feel like a good example of that too is, so like refraction and reflect, you know, basically anything that has IOR and you can see through, translucency, transparency to it, like glass, for example, it's one of those shaders that's like, what's the best glass shader for Octane? What's the best glass shader for, you know, Redshift, Cycles, etc. The silliest hack for me was like, I would make all, you know, I first started learning it. I would make like I'd make a glass and I'd be like, this looks really good. It's going to look good. I swear. Put it on. I'm like, something is not right. It's because every piece of refractive glass plastic has some thickness to it.
Yeah.
Solidify your mesh and not just like, I mean, in the case of Blender, don't like throw a solidify modifier across the whole thing evenly. You know, if you look at a glass, parts of the glass have like thicker, you know, at the base of the glass, there's a little more thickness. Yeah. At the lip, there's a little less. Maybe it's more beveled. And when you start to sort of understand why all these things, you know, visually amount to what they do when you see them, you get those moments where you're in a program and you throw it on, you're like, oh my God, that was the thing. Like, that's the thing I was trying to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It turns out it was when you make things more realistic in a physical way, like they look more realistic.
Yeah. And it takes like honing. It's not just honing your skills at being good as an artist. It's like observational skills. You need to be able to look at stuff and say like, break down, you know, the macro details all the way to the micro details. What am I actually seeing? Like, what's in my field of vision? I think that for me has always been such an exciting part about what we do, is like being able to translate it like that is such a fun experience.
Mm-hmm. So I got to jump into the future stuff here, even though I technically want to ask so many questions, but before, I want to ask just one last question. Do you have, especially for maybe beginners, but having such a long history in 3D, what would be like the one tip you'd maybe give to somebody just jumping into the industry, or even maybe professionals that you think might not know this?
I think honestly, so the biggest boon for my career was doing the 100 days thing. This was like 2019. So I would say like, just make stuff every day. Like, force yourself to do something every day. It doesn't have to be that great, but like, make something and put it out there in the world. That's probably what I'd say. Cause I think that alone, it was such an amazing, just creative process. And also it ended up getting me a lot of work. And I mean, you know, I was lucky and I my animations hit the right eyes. Right. But you know, I think just, you're not going to, if you're trying to, especially if you're trying to become a freelancer or just get a job in 3D, like people have to see what you're doing. So, you know, make something every day and post it somewhere. I think that.
Right. And I mean, I appreciate the humility of saying your stuff hit the right eyes, but I feel like the bigger point is that those eyes would have never been hit if you weren't doing it to begin with, you know?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, unfortunately, because I had to refresh, I lost the soundboard. Another reason for OBS in the future. But we can go boo, boo, boo. All right. So that's jumping in. All right. welcome to the future segment of the podcast. This is where we go over pretty much just all of where we think the future digital art design is going and the tools on what's going to be leading us into our exciting art journey and future. So, this is, and there's also no judgment, you know, hate, love, doesn't matter. We're just here together having a good time and sharing ideas. So, with that being said, we're going to go ahead and start off with our strong one first. This one's been disrupting the industry. Tom, AI, is it evil or is it good?
Oh, man.
What's your thoughts?
You know, I think it lies somewhere right in the middle there. It is terrifying. I'll tell you that. It is terrifying. But also really, really cool. So I don't know, man. I mean, I just started playing around with Stable Diffusion last week. Just I was in between projects, and I've been seeing all the stuff coming out, and yeah, it's wild. It's insane. I think the industry is definitely going to change. It has changed already, but I think it's going to be very different in the next few years. And it's a little frightening with some of the stuff they're coming out with, but it's also insanely cool. I don't know. Maybe Andrew, maybe you could speak to this more. I know that Blender has like a direct, link.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually very recent. I mean, that's
Stability AI, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's stuff like that where it's like, okay, I don't know. I mean, part of me is like, every time a new tool comes out that makes like things easier for an artist, like that's and more accessible to more people, like I think that's overall a good thing. But I do think it's gonna really, really disrupt the industry. Like, I don't think that, I don't know. It brings everyone up to a similar level, and then it makes it so that the creativity, like, it's a given that you're going to get like a good image with AI, right? Like if everybody can make like a good image out of words and not have the technical know-how of like what they're doing, like I think there's benefits to that, but there's also just like, I think that's kind of a bummer too. Cause it's like, I mean, for one thing, I just love doing this. Like I love the process of like learning, like we were just talking about, like, you don't have to learn all this stuff, which I like. I think it's cool. So, I think that kind of sucks. But also, like, yeah, you can, if it enables a storyteller who doesn't have the technical know-how to make something amazing, like, then that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also can't help but just feel like, I spent a lot of time reading about this stuff. And to your point, Tom, it's to the point of discomfort. Like, I do not, there are times where, like, it really does start to just be like, oh my God, this is going to be, a black swan event, right? Where it's like, no one thought that it would be, visual art is going to be the first, you know, we've had Teslas, we've had the concept of self-driving cars, or like, we thought for sure it was going to be all this other stuff that got disrupted first. And I think, I think that you've, summarized it well in the sense that like, it's going to be, so I think the longer it's been here long enough now, and it's part of the dialogue that it's going to have to be somewhere in the middle. Like, I do not think that you're going to have an influx of AI images and then suddenly everyone's going to be like, that's the only thing I want. I think it's just going to be a lot of the traditional advice that you get as an artist, whether it's like the niche down mentality or the become a specialist, be really good at simulation work, be really good at optimizing render engines or photorealism or whatever, or aesthetically, maybe you have a genre that you work really well in. Things are going to, if anything, if all the other stuff is getting decreased in value because there's so much of it, the other side of it will likely, become more valuable. I mean, it's maybe hard to see that future now, but like I just don't think that it's going to be this, not everyone is going to be displaced overnight. And I think the worst thing you could do now is to sort of linger in the gray area. Like, you should learn it. You should learn what's going on. You should learn if it's something that works for your workflow, and if it doesn't, you don't have to use it.
Right. No, yeah. I fully agree. And I think it is like it's clearly a very powerful tool. Like,
right.
And, you know, I think we're still just scratching the surface of what it can actually do. But like, you know, I've worked with some people who are already using it for concept design. And it's amazing for a pre-production side of things where it's like, I don't know exactly what I want, but let's just try out like 10 different styles and see if it's, we get close to something that like speaks to you.
And which to that point, I actually wanted to ask you this specifically. Like, I feel like I look at your work, right? Let's just take, for the sake of the example, the Thomas series, right? To me, AI is really good at matching things that you might not normally have in the same sort of neuron pathway. Like you might not always associate, well, you probably would never associate Thomas the Tank Engine with like pure horror, right? Like those are not two ideas that you would, you have managed to bring those two together in an amazing way. Could you see maybe like some, to the point of concept art, do you think that AI would be useful in maybe extending the universe of, you know, Thomas the Terror kind of thing, or the Vertigo series, for example? Like, do you think that is something that would be a useful tool for you? It doesn't replace you as the, you know, originator of the idea, but can kind of extend that universe a bit.
Totally. And for the record, I have tried to see what would happen if I tried to make a Thomas spider on through AI, and it doesn't work right now, at least with the prompts that I'm giving it. I mean, to be fair, I don't really know what I'm doing. So like,
sure.
Who knows? But I mean, totally. Like, I feel like, especially in the next few months, like, and given the fact that you can train it on your own data now, you know, like, if I fed it a frame, all the frames that I made of Thomas from every video, like, I could probably get something pretty close if I wanted to say, like, this is now a different character, and he's green, and he's, like, whatever. Probably. But so could everybody else, right?
right.
Yeah.
And I guess that is sort of the moral conundrum of all this right now, where I think so much of this is, you know, the Corridor Crew video with the anime thing is just sparking this whole conversation of like, okay, so you can't, you know, I don't think 2 years ago, if you'd told me, can you copyright a style or an aesthetic? I probably would have said no, because I think that like that would have 2 years ago, that would have, it wouldn't have worked in the context of how everyone was operating. But now it's kind of like, I mean, damn, dude, people are using artist names as prompts to get a specific result, like all the time, right? Even render engines, like in the style of, you know, like, so we clearly are, the data is trained to understand what those things mean.
Right.
So if that's the case and they provide value to the end result, I mean, maybe the conversation needs to be revisited. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I know that there are plenty of lawsuits coming, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Make as much random generated art as you can, kids. The lawyers are coming.
What is it? The big one is Shutter. Is it Shutterstock?
Shutterstock. Yeah, that was wild. The case, I've read so much into it. It's very interesting. There's things like, so essentially one of the biggest defenses they have is that Google essentially has gotten so many lawsuits on this, but when they take images from people's website, right? Like if you type in Michael Steinberg, a bunch of my photos are going to populate, right? Mm-hmm. When there's a technology that's so new, they get this, like, it's called Better for Humanity break. And it's like, it's okay. Like, it's good for humanity and it's new technology, so we don't want to like make a decision, and it's fine. And everybody seems happy. The general consensus around the world is it's cool. And so it was very interesting, but apparently like Google kind of went through the same thing with search engines. And it's like, people are getting my images offline and I never said they could. I put it in this library or I put it in this museum. Right. And now people are like, can take and copy and paste my image onto their computer. This motherfucker has my image as his desktop on Windows 98, this motherfucker, you know. And so it's an interesting thing, but apparently that kind of laid a big groundwork that they're using right now for that case going forward.
Well, and what was the, I think in our Discord channel, we had a conversation around the argument that was made. So there was a pretty popular case that was recently ruled on that as a collection of, it was the comic book. It was the comic book that was made from all AI images.
Mm. Looked so like just like Tizan or Zendaya.
Right. Exactly. Zendaya. The ruling was that each individual image could not be copyrighted, right? But as a collection or as a curation of work, it could fit the, you know, I don't know copyright law. I'm not a copyright lawyer, mm-hmm. but essentially it sounds like there are different ways to apply for copyright. And so some, you know, as a collection or as a curator, you could receive the, you know, it's legible for that kind of copyright protection. Mm. But if you were to say, if I ever see this single image posted on another person's website or put, you know, that is not that's not something that would be upheld. So it's interesting because there's now, you know, now it's just this intersection of copyright law and AI and art, you know, artist rights. Uh-huh. And what do you agree to when you use Instagram or Shutterstock or fill in the blank?
One thing I feel that could be good. I was just talking with somebody. I'm not drinking this year, but I still went to a bar last night and got a wonderful non-alcoholic beer. They're still 0.5% though. So if I have like 20 of them, I can get a little buzz, but I was having one and, some guy, we started talking about it and I feel like one of the goods that could come from AI, because it's interesting as we have this conversation, we don't really know anything about copyright laws. We don't really know how this lawsuit might work out, but imagine if you could kind of ask a copyright AI, right? And just ask it kind of these questions like, well, what did you do? What did you think? And now all of a sudden you're getting instant answers to yourself. That could be a pretty cool use case for artists when it comes to some of this stuff, you know, and it might say something like, you have to add in filters, or you have to add, like, adjust the composition at least 20% more, or yeah, something to at least change the artwork. You know, that would be an interesting use case.
You could ask it like which artist is referencing specifically, or like what data it's been trained on.
Yeah, all of it, you know, and like the copyright, you know, and it could tell. And it's like, well, I want to post this in a, you know, like a book. And it's like, okay, well, you use three images. That's not enough for you to have your own artistic angle on it. Like, you're going to need at least 10 more generated images in this sort of content, or with text to go with it, to have your narrative story to break copyright law. You know, I don't know, just something like that could be pretty
I think that's the thing that's crazy about AI, is that like it seems that like the data specific things that are data forward, right, that things that are like, let me ask you a question, can I do this thing, and an AI tells you yes you can, I've referenced, you know, it's crazy that like, for example, ChatGPT was not connected to the internet when it dropped, you know, it's like, it's not, mm-hmm. these are not things that are happening in real time. So those kind of bots, I'm like, that's kind of what I expected from AI. The image to generation tools like Midjourney and Stable Diffusion and DALL-E, those are the ones where, and it's crazy because I think it's almost in a way good that those are what blew up first, because I don't know if you've stumbled across it as much as I have, but the black box conversation is huge, which is like the most worrisome part of AI is that there is so much happening that if you asked the engineers of that AI, why is the AI making those decisions? How did it come to those conclusions? How did it generate that image? There is the gap of what we know it's doing and what we don't know what it's doing is growing so fast, yeah. that like, How do you take that to copyright court? If you can't say this is what an AI did to make this image, you can't enforce the end result of that image, because you don't, you know, it's not just the data it was trained on. It was what data points did it reference within its own model to create this image? Yeah. And how do you go back to each of those data points and say, this artist did copyright this work, or this artist didn't?
Oh,
you know, I mean,
man, what if we get the copyright AI trainers to copy all the other copyright AI cases. And it can defend itself because it learned the cases. Amazing.
It's funny you say that though, Michael, because I think law is one of the places. I think copywriting, law, SEO, those are the things that are kind of popping up as like, we'll probably see some pretty crazy AI happening here. So,
yeah.
Didn't ChatGPT pass the bar?
It did. Woo. Now it's interesting. I was saying, so some people are saying that it's getting kind of answers not as accurate anymore. Mm. And this was the kind of the coolest little chart I saw, but it was a a U, imagine that, right? And it was like knowledge going up on the left side, and then on the down plane, it was accuracy of what I want, accuracy. Mm-hmm. And it said the least knowledge it had, it would almost be more accurate, maybe not exactly, but it was pretty dang accurate, right? Mm-hmm. But then the more knowledge it had so many more equations coming into the question that it was sometimes wrong. But even though it's getting wrong, we're training it better. So now it's like experimenting with other options. So then eventually it's going to get better again. So it's like almost has to get worse and give us more wrong answers for us to say, don't do that, do that, to get itself trained to then become better again. And so interesting. Like the more data, anyway, I thought that was like an interesting, I was like, oh, that makes sense. Cause I have honestly, noticed
it's kind of how the human brain works, you know?
Yeah.
You hit plateaus in learning and you have to, you either know too little or you don't know enough.
Yeah.
It's very rarely that you know just enough.
Yeah. It's interesting. Well, I'm very, you know, there's so much more talk about AI, but there are a few other great conversations to be had. Jumping on to our next topic, and I am curious with you, because I don't think I've actually seen anything in this realm, but NFTs, you know, have you done anything in the NFT world? Have you dropped anything? Have you had any buyers? Have you bought any? What's your view on NFTs as a whole?
For sure. So I haven't been really up to date on NFTs for about a year. But when they first started in, I guess, like winter of 2021, I guess, I was like part of this like large artist group that we all got together with David Aria. He kind of.
Yeah, he's
edited a lot of it. And just like there's a ton of like incredible 3D artists there. There's this just really nice community just like discovering NFTs basically and like learning about it. And I did end up so. The very first Vertigo piece that I had made was part of an NFT like collection for the whole group. So like everyone was doing a distorted reality piece. And so my very first one was as part of that. And so that sold. And then I ended up selling 3 out of 4 of the Vertigo pieces just as one of ones. I haven't done any like large scale kind of big pieces, but NFTs are interesting. Cause I think, you know, it's so ripe for scams where the parts that I like about NFTs are that it allows artists to make something it validates digital art as an art form in the sense that people are funding people to make digital art. So for an artist who's a freelancer and, I didn't really consider what I was doing like art until NFTs really. I knew that they were like, I enjoyed it and they were artistic for sure, but digital art at that time before NFTs wasn't really taken seriously as an art form, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I think it is more now that there's value associated with it, which is stupid, but you know. The parts I like about it is like, it gives artists a platform to sell and to sell what they're making and to like be, it's like a little mini renaissance for digital artists, I guess, just to kind of have a patron and you know, make something. But then there's all these huge PFP projects and all this stuff, which I just don't follow. There's too much mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I'm kind of excited about, I've been getting a little bit more into, especially this week, just looking a bit more into blockchain technology. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, I feel like blockchain technology is going to be, and now I'm kind of realizing there's just so many other use cases besides just art, which is, again, it's kind of funny. It's like this massive breakthrough technology is kind of starting in the art world and then it's kind of breaking out into other fields. But with blockchains, yeah, it's like, you know, but say, for instance, just even doing donations and stuff, you can see art being kind of like attached to that in all aspects and realms. And so I feel like as, you know, tokens are getting sent or as, you know, even I feel like fundraisers, you know, I feel like a lot of times you ask people about why don't you donate more? It's like, oh, they're not even getting the money. You know, imagine if you could trace blockchain to make sure it's going exactly in their hands.
Yeah.
And you could see a lot more art being kind of like, you know, maybe even a portion of that goes to the artist. And you see like there's like an art coin or something that's labeled with their brand. And each one of those transaction goes a little bit to the artist. That's mm-hmm. also pretty cool. Like kind of, I don't know. I've been like getting into more of than just the gallery space. I've been thinking like, oh crap. Like it really could be for everything, every transaction possible.
I don't know if it's because we asked these two questions back to back, but part of me is like, how great would it have been if we had a file format or we had metadata baked into all the images that you put on the internet, right? Which we didn't even really start talking about that kind of data until big data started getting so profitable, right? But imagine you as an artist, you publish a piece, right? When you sign up for your Adobe subscription or your Blender, you know, when you make your Blender profile or whatever, you got all this stuff that anything you make within the suite of your products is tagged with your name. How great would it have been if the data sets that were trained on AI had to incorporate some fractional percentage of metadata? You know, if you trained it on these 10 artists, then you can say 0.6% of the pixels. I don't know. What it would look like, but that is to me, that is democratization, right? Like democratization is not stripping the people who have learned how to use the tools and making it accessible to everyone. And the person that learned how to use them or niche down to a specific style or art direction, they're not losing out on it. It's more just like, yeah, if you want to use the things that I learned, fine. But like, I should probably get paid like a little bit for it. If you're going to get paid for what you're making with the tool set, you know, it's just, but the problem is that all of this is happening kind of in many ways backwards, where it's like, digital art has a renaissance. Suddenly we're like, oh, digital art, blockchain technology. And we're like, oh, well, actually the AIs that we're building right now are being trained on like 15 years of data that, you know, that none of this stuff existed for. So we're going to, once again, on the technology side of things, we're going to be playing catch up. It's going to be this constant chasing the sort of like, we're going to fix one thing and realize we missed another. And I just hope that, you know, as quickly as the AI stuff is happening, that we can kind of sort out that side of things too, because it's pretty obvious. I think that's why it's so divisive. It's pretty obvious to a lot of people that like this might not have been the best way to roll all this out.
Yeah. I would be a big fan of, you know, I feel like you'd need a completely new social platform to kind of almost incorporate it to get rid of the things that aren't blockchain technology, but I could see something being interesting where like anything you upload has to have had either it was like minted or blockchain verified. And then what would be cool too is like, even if you're, and if the process becomes so fast, it's like you take a photo with your phone and you upload it to Facebook. Well, it's like identifying that I made the photo. And even if you made it so it was like, you can't necessarily share other people's stuff, or maybe you could, but it would be always directly linked to that artist. Like, oh, this is an interesting article, like, or anything of that nature. It's always directly to the store. I don't know. It's an interesting, NFTs and blockchain. It's an exciting time. I feel like we could see some fun things happening, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm definitely interested to see what happens in the next few years with it. Again, I've sort of not been paying too close of attention to it about the last year. And I feel like with that amount of time, it's just a completely different landscape. I just have no idea what's going on anymore, but
And I guess, so to maybe pivot from, cause both of the NFT and the AI stuff, those are right now still abstract enough that they're sort of like philosophical questions.
That's what this part's about, you know, hypotheticals.
I will say, I think we're moving off of the sort of, it's less philosophical to talk about VR and AR. I mean, they are here, they are happening. It's, everyone's got it. Instagram's got filters, you know, Snapchat's got filters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have Meta, who has now developed multiple headsets. We have Apple, who's dropping headsets. And I think I asked you earlier in the episode, Tom, just about, have you ever considered bringing like a Vertigo piece into
an experience? God.
Again, VR? Maybe you could do it for like, you could do it for like five to 10 seconds, but I think it would still be cool to like break down.
I mean,
as an artist who's been doing 3D work for as long as you have and who has had such success with it, do you find yourself thinking, I want to maybe experiment with AR or VR?
Yeah, definitely. And I have a little, very, very small amount of that. Like, you know, I have a Rift S. So I've played, I've had that for a few years. So I've just been playing with that. But, you know, I've done a couple of extremely basic, like very, very brief forays into Unreal. So I can just make like a super simple VR scene and bring in a model or two. And just like, you know, I do like modeling for fun and just like, you know, bring those in and see if I can like walk around and stuff like that. But the amount that I'm doing with that is pretty limited for the most part. But yes, absolutely. I would love to experiment with that some more. And, you know, but yeah, the idea of the rendering power and resolution output that I would have to actually make to get like a decent render in to see in VR that doesn't look like garbage. Right now, I just feel like, I mean, there's upscaling and there's stuff you can do, but you know, there's only so much you can, there's only so big of a file you can give to, you know, some of these players on VR that will actually play back smoothly and all this stuff. So it's, but yes, I would love to. I hope that in the next few years, there's like kind of more accessible tools for, you know, specifically for kind of 3D, bringing your own stuff into there.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like, it's kind of a good point you're saying about other people, because I feel like I have like a pretty kick-ass machine, you know, running like a Titan, 128 gigs of RAM, and like, it's like I get to play like some of these experiences and I made it, but it's like, I can't share it with anybody. It's kind of lonely. It's like,
I can do it for myself and just see like my own work and then just like, okay, this is cool. Mm-hmm.
And the file gigs are so massive. It's like, I don't even want to keep it on here. It's like 50 gigs and you're like, so okay, well.
It's interesting to hear this too, because like I have very limited experience with VR. I mean, I have experience with it. I have experience with AR. I've made some spark filters and stuff, but I do have experience with like React development and doing some like web app stuff, right? And one of the first things I feel like that really clicked for me was like, when you are, every browser has mobile throttling as an option, right? So you can request a web page and have it run as if you were on a 4G network with like an iPhone 8, you know? And that is how you should be testing all of the stuff you're making, right? Especially in an industry where you're basically expected to keep up with pretty much bleeding edge tech, like the most recent GPUs, the fastest CPUs, the most RAM you can cram into it. VR experiences, it's really crazy to hear you guys say this, because I'm like, I haven't really developed for VR, but I would be curious to know if there's emulators that are like, if I'm using the Quest 2 or whatever, you know, with this spec computer, what is this thing actually going to run at? Because it's pretty I mean, I have a very beefy machine. I'm pretty much always on at least 1 year, within 1 year of whatever has been released. That's pretty much how often I'm updating my computer. It would probably be useless for me to like load in a 1 million poly thing and see it on my computer in VR and be like, this is sick, and then send it to people. And they're like, I can't even open the file. You crashed my computer.
Yeah. Right.
So there's also this sort of like, in the same way we were just talking about democratization of art through maybe blockchain or NFTs or any of that stuff, there's also like, these experiences need to be, if we want to talk about accessibility and, you know, being able to experience the same thing regardless of what you have access to, that's a huge part of it too, I would imagine.
Yeah. And yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of it will kind of come down to more like, I mean, obviously like the hardware is going to improve, but also like the bandwidth that you can maybe just stream from a much more powerful machine. Like, I mean, that technology exists already and like it works pretty well. So I don't know if like what like the VR side of that is right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was like a big part of it.
Yeah, if cloud computing just like stepped in and was like, we'll render it for you.
Yeah, we'll just send you HD video that you can look at. Like,
yeah.
I just got the PlayStation VR 2 came out last week. And just off the bat, I haven't made a video or anything on it yet, but the pass-through. So this sounds lame, and it's so hard to describe VR sometimes without having actual visuals and seeing it. But even though it was in black and white, I could see through it as like an AR experience. Mm-hmm. And to photo map my room, you didn't have to, with the Quest, you kind of draw, and, you know, same with the Index. But with the PlayStation, you just look and you see the entire room glow as it starts tracing everything you start to look at. And it also has eye tracking. So like it's trippy. It's like you're looking at like four options and then you just look at it and you don't even move your controller and it's just like blink. And you're just like, oh, I can't. It's like whatever I'm looking at, it knows what I'm looking at. There are some cool things. Sorry, I got a little sidetracked there. But it's the going back to the power statement. It was a very interesting feeling to see a, you know, something where lots of people can use. It was almost like a first mainstream headset that is could support AAA games. Because prior to that, it was the Quest 2. And that thing can't even run like Minecraft, you know. I mean, it can. It's actually, it's good. But as a standalone, it wasn't very good. But to have an actual VR headset operating on a pretty beefy machine, the PS5 isn't any joke. You know, it can run Unreal Engine 5, the Matrix game. And being on, you know, that high caliber at an at-home kind of headset for just a common user, it's kind of exciting. Like, I could see it really making a big splash. Like, it's not immediate now, but I feel like in a few months or a year, you're going to get a lot more indie developers being really excited about what they can create on this machine. So I feel like AAA VR games might be coming back, which is exciting.
I hope you're right. I mean, I haven't been playing a ton of VR lately, but
yeah,
I had, you know, a very solid Beat Saber kick, you know, when I first got it. And this game, Hot Dogs, Horseshoes, and Hand Grenades, is very fun, and a bunch of other ones. But yeah, no, it's like there's really not, I feel like there's kind of a lack of good games that have come out recently, you know.
Yeah.
Like, some stuff, like, I guess, like,
it's interesting, like, that sentiment coincides with the fact that everyone is about to release new tech, you know, where it's sort of like it would make sense that there's a lull. It's like, it's the same thing with console gaming, where, you know, you meet the upper threshold of the hardware you have, and you're sort of like, well, the stuff we want to do, we can't do until we have a new technology to build on. So
right.
Yeah, I'm excited about, I don't know, I just want, sorry, I just got it, so I'm talking about it. But I just want, if Sony's CEO is listening, goddamn it, please, I just want VR chat on the PlayStation VR 2. Like, I have my Index, I can do it in here, but it's just, you know, my wife, I would love for us both to be able to jump on at the same time. It's just like, put that game on there. It's open source. It's awesome. Super creative. That'd be great. If you're listening, CEO.
Yeah, keep an ear out, Sony.
Yeah.
And I think to that end, I mean, we're pretty close here. I guess I also wanted to just open up the other part of the future segment, kind of back to you, Tom, is just, you know, what are you working on now? Do you have any projects coming up? Do you have anything that people should be looking out for if they're following your work that's going to drop here in the next few months?
I'm not working on any crazy things right now. I definitely want to, I will be making plenty more kind of weird, trippy stuff for sure. I mean, that'll be coming out, you know. I've been wanting to kind of get back into just making more things. Like I was saying before, like, it was one of the best things for my career, and I kind of just wanted, I don't know if I can handle doing 100 days again, just because I wasn't working at that time.
Right.
But I do anticipate hopefully being able to at least put out some more, maybe not daily, but, you know, kind of more steady, smaller animations probably. And I'm sure I'll make another Thomas at some point. So that'll be coming down the pipe at some point.
Awesome. Yeah, we're looking forward to it. And I also will just say, I really appreciate hearing from you, like someone who, as an artist that I look up to and think like, wow, I would love to accomplish what you've accomplished. It's really nice to hear you sort of being honest about, burnout is real, right? Oh, yeah. And like, you can do 100 days, but you can't do 500 days. Like, you might be, you know, maybe you can. And if you can, that's amazing. I just think that a lot of the content that I see around our industry can be very big on like, you got to do stuff all the time. Like, if you're not doing it all the time, you're not doing it. You know, for me, getting in the, you know, I've also been in the industry for about 10, you know, 10, 11 years now. You get to a point where you're like, dude, there, you know, sometimes the best thing you can do is nothing at all. Like,
yeah.
You know, go out and observe. You just said you got back from, yeah, you just got back from vacation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Take some time.
Exactly. You know. It's necessary. And like, you know, there are just times where like, you know, I just need to just not think about it at all for a couple of weeks, and then I'll be rearing to go. Especially with that kind of thing, I feel like a lot of the time inspiration hits in weird times. So like, especially if you haven't made something for a while, or, you know, if you have to put yourself into new situations. So like, you know, I'll think of things on vacation, or if I'm going on a hike, or like walking around, even just anything, like, you know, inspiration can come kind of from anywhere. So, you know, just go do cool things, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I speak for Michael as well. We are very excited to see what you have coming, and I'm glad that you've had some time to like refresh a little bit. And we're looking forward to seeing what you come down with.
Thanks so much.